ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future. I'm your host, Eric Anderson, and today we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Michael Behe about his new book, A Mousetrap for Darwin. Great to chat with you again, Mike.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. Always happy to be with you.
Well, Mike, if you can believe it, today is our eighth conversation about your new book. It's been incredibly valuable to walk through so many of the important issues that you've raised in your previous three books and your responses to critics. Last time we talked about the famous long-term evolutionary experiment headed by Richard Lenski and some of the key lessons this experiment provides about the limitations of the evolutionary process. Indeed, if we view the data objectively without the blinders or the assumption that Darwinian evolution is some great creative power, we recognize that this experiment and other evolutionary experiments really show de-evolution, a breaking of genes, messing with promoters, loss of function, loss of information, and in the long term even, a negative spiral that's kind of heading toward extinction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, just like people thought, Darwinian evolution works, but it works mainly by breaking things that were already there. That can help and adapt to different environments, but it does not build things in an organism. It merely degrades them.
Right. So today I want to delve into parts 5 and 6 of your new book to capture some additional takeaways from recent laboratory and field evidence.
Yeah, sounds good.
So one of the common arguments that comes up in the debate over evolution is that there's lots of ways evolution could have gone, lots of things that could have worked. So we can't analyze probabilities based on a particular scenario. The ability for evolution to achieve functional results is far easier than it seems from just looking at the biological systems in front of us. There must be untold things that could have worked, and what we see is just whatever was, you know, happened to be left over by natural selection. If we bring that down to the molecular level and discuss specific mutations, for example, one well-known evolutionist, Larry Moran, argued against your analysis of the malaria parasite by claiming, when such a mutation arises, it was only one of millions and millions of possible evolutionary outcomes. And then using a card-playing analogy, he says, there's no a priori requirement that you get a specific hand in the next deal. Is Moran right that there are lots of ways evolution could work, and so the particular scenario we have in front of us is unremarkable? How do we assess this kind of argument?
That's what you would think, or that's what people did think up until recently. They figured, well, if you can't solve an evolutionary problem one way, well, maybe you can do it another. But the neatest thing about research in the past 20, 30 years is that now we have data to show what evolution can do. And that's what I was talking about in The Edge of Evolution and a lot of my responses to Larry Moran, who is a retired professor of biochemistry at the University of Toronto, a prominent evolutionary biologist. He's interested in evolution. That's what several of my essays respond to, his objections. And I pointed out in Edge of Evolution that the resistance to chloroquine, the drug that was used to treat malaria, developed very, very slowly. And it was estimated by one malariologist, a guy named Nicholas White, prominent scientist, that the de novo, brand new origin of resistance to chloroquine by malaria occurs only once in every 10 to the 20th malarial parasite replications. And 10 to the 20th is a huge number, beyond astronomical. You know, there are only 10 to the 11th stars in the Milky Way. So this takes an awful lot of chances to get there. So I said that getting two necessary mutations where one alone doesn't do, if you need two at a time, that's going to be on the order of that malaria number, the 1 in 10 to the 20th. Because later work that I talk about in the essays and in the book showed that a minimum of two mutations were necessary before you get any anti-chloroquine activity. And Larry Moran countered that, well, you know, that's just one way you can get resistance to malaria. You can get all sorts of mutations, other mutations, and it's very likely that you'll get lots of other chloroquine resistance mutations. But that completely misses the power of the malaria data. And that is that if it takes you a certain amount of time or generations to get a mutation, then any mutation that is more probable than the one you got would have occurred earlier, because mutation is happening all the time in all the genes of malaria. It's not confined to just the ones that we're focusing on. So if the mutation of another gene could have helped more easily, then we would have expected that to occur first. It's kind of like saying, well, you know, if you win the lottery with, you know, this unusual five different numbers, well, maybe you could have won it with just two numbers. But you can't, because you need five numbers, say, to match a particular lottery.
Right.
And in this instance, any mutation that was more common, more probable than the one we found, would have showed up. So Moran is incorrect, and that's a common misconception. It just shows the mistakes you can make when you don't have sufficient data to constrain your speculation.
Yeah. And just to bring this home, I think whenever these kinds of things are put forward, at least I haven't seen any details about which mutation or which change is being proposed. It's just a sort of a blanket assertion. Well, lots of things could have worked, so there's nothing special about what we see. And yet, as you note, in a case where we have some data now, if anything else would have worked, why don't we see it? And I love what you wrote at the end of one of your essays. You said, if nature were thick with possible complex biochemical systems that could be found by Darwinian processes, we should expect to, in fact, find some when we go looking. We don't.
That's exactly right. So you can speculate all you want, but nature doesn't care.
So in part five of the book, you talk about some work done by Joseph Thornton. I think he was originally at the University of Oregon and later at the University of Chicago. Tell us what he was working on and the concept of Dolo's Law.
Sure. In the cell, in DNA, there's frequently genes that code for proteins that are similar but not identical. And usually they do very similar things, but somewhat different. And scientists have thought for a long time that the way these can arise is through gene duplication. That is, some gene existed in the misty past, and during replication of the organism, the processes which duplicate the DNA to make new cells and stuff make a mistake. They copy a gene and something goes wrong, and they go back and copy it again, so that you have two copies of a particular gene where once you had just one. And then the story goes that maybe the new gene can accumulate mutations and get some new activity, new role in the cell that it didn't have before. Mm-hmm. And Joseph Thornton decided to test whether a gene that codes for a protein that binds a steroid hormone and uses that as a signal to tell the cell to do things, and there's a couple different ones, whether that could duplicate and give rise to a more specialized kind of gene. And without going into detail, he said that in one instance, a newer gene couldn't go back and give rise to the older gene. And he said that this was a test of Dolo's Law, and it showed that Dolo's Law, at least in this instance, held.
Okay, who's Dolo?
Well, yeah, he's not a household name these days, but in the early 20th century, early 1900s, he was a paleobiologist. He looked at fossils and stuff, and he said that you can always distinguish an ancestral form from a descendant form. And he said that if a feature is lost in a lineage, it won't be regained. And Stephen Jay Gould, the famous late evolutionary biologist, wrote about Louis Dolo once, and he pointed out that this law was actually an assumption, or it was a postulate to help Dolo make sense out of fossils or keep fossils in line with his ideas. These days, scientists take that law with a grain of salt. That is, the idea that you can't get a trait back once it's lost in a lineage, at least at the whole organism level. As an example, you know, whales live in the ocean and they're descended kind of circuitously, it's thought, from fish. Well, fish gave rise to land vertebrates and mammals, and one branch of mammals went back into the sea. But whales don't have gills like fish have gills. And you could think that that's an application of Dolo's law, that gills can't re-evolve. Scientists don't really think that's an iron law. But nonetheless, that's at the whole organism level. And Thornton and other folks, too, wanted to test it at the molecular level, at the level of proteins and genes. So he asked the question, if you have this modern steroid receptor, is it possible to go back to what he deduced would have been the ancient ancestor form by a Darwinian process of changing one amino acid in the protein at a time and retaining its function, its ability to bind steroid hormones?
Yeah, and they ran up against this sort of this wall, if you will, which they referred to as kind of a molecular Dolo's law, and said, I think, if I'm quoting correctly here, as evolution proceeds, shifts in protein structure function relations become increasingly difficult to reverse whenever the shifts have complex architectures.
Yeah, that's right. Essentially, they said that you can't go home again. But once you change into the modern one, you can't go back to get the ancient one without going through non-functional steps. So they declared that Dolo's law worked in that instance at the molecular level.
Yeah. So this is an important acknowledgement of the limitation in the evolutionary biology community that there's a serious issue here. But there's also something else kind of hiding in plain sight. And as a result of your analysis and other research you've done, you propose something you call the time symmetric Dolo's law. What is that?
Yeah, well, Dolo's law, as I said, says that if you have an ancestor that has a trait and you have an evolutionary lineage and that trait is lost, then you can't go back and re-evolve that trait. So it talks about the past going to the future. But at the molecular level, changes in a molecule can go either way. You can mutate a particular position from one amino acid to another, but there is no reason, there's no distinguishing that really from mutating the second amino acid to the first and back again. I pointed out that evolution at the molecular level is time symmetric. You know, just like laws of physics, for example, if you had a film of a billiard ball bouncing off cushions of a pool table, and you ran the film forward or you ran it backward, you wouldn't be able to tell which one was forward in time and which was backward in time. It all looks the same. You can think the same thing for evolution at the molecular level. And kind of to put a point on it, there's no reason that that second steroid receptor protein had to have been the one in the future that descended from the first one. It could just as easily have been the original protein. And then if you wanted, or if evolution had a use for the ancestor protein, it would be cut off. You could not re-evolve, as Thornton and his group showed, you could not re-evolve that original activity. So in my essays, and I write that the original Dolo's law kind of cut off the evolution backwards from a particular state to its ancestor state. I say that a time symmetric Dolo's law cuts off evolution by Darwinian means, not only from the past to the future, it cuts it off both ways in time, so that instead of just saying that you can't re-evolve some old complex trait, it says you can't evolve a complex trait by Darwinian means, either re-evolve it or evolve it in the first place.
Right.
Because you would always run into the kinds of constraints that Joseph Thornton identified in this particular system he was looking at.
Yeah, so just to maybe simplify this a little bit for our listeners, so the molecules don't care whether I'm doing a mutation today or whether I was doing a mutation 1,000 years ago or 1,000,000 years ago. And so, you know, if I can't evolve a particular trait today, because of these constraints that it's running into, then to put it bluntly, what reason do I have to believe that I could have evolved it in the past? Why is the past any easier than the future? If we can't evolve it going forward, you know, what's our expectation for the past? So good. Yeah, no, that's very helpful.
Yeah, and it's interesting to notice that natural selection will closely fit a gene or a protein to its present day function. It's what it's doing right now, and it doesn't care about the past, and it doesn't care about the future either. Right. So those restrictions go in both time directions.
Yeah, and I think there's some valuable engineering-related principles here as well. I think, you know, back to Moran's comment about lots of solutions, there may be several solutions to a particular problem, not the millions and millions that are sometimes naively claimed, but there might be several solutions to a particular problem. But once you start heading down a particular path toward a particular solution, then things get constrained very quickly. And right. you end up having to deal with a specific subset of components and integrated parts and irreducible complexity and coordinated mutations and all the things that go into how this is going to function in the real world.
Exactly. I think evolutionary biologists should all be made to take an engineering 101 course. And
they probably resolve a lot of the problems we see. So another piece of Thornton's and colleagues' research had to do with VATPase. Tell us about that.
An ATPase is a very important molecular machine which helps make energy in cells and in various compartments of cells too. And it turns out that in all cells, all eukaryotic cells, there's a particular subset of ATPases called the VATPase. And that's got a ring of six proteins as a kind of a subset or one piece of the molecular machine. And in almost all eukaryotes, that six-membered ring consists of five proteins of one type and one of a second type. There's an exception, though, in the group of eukaryotes called fungi, you know, like mushrooms and so on. There are four proteins of one type, one of another, and a third kind of protein. And that third kind of protein looks a lot like the second kind. So people thought, well, maybe it duplicated and somehow insinuated itself into the six-membered ring. Thornton's group asked the question, well, could that be done starting with the six-membered ring that had five copies and one copy? And they determined that, yeah, if a second copy of that second gene, it gets tricky to follow, duplicated, then by what they call neutral processes, that is processes that don't hurt or help an organism, it could lose a binding site for, say, the back end of the first protein, and the second protein could lose a binding site for the front end of the first protein. Mm-hmm. And then it would all be required to make the six-membered ring. All three different proteins would be required to make that six-membered ring. The important point here, at least for my purposes, is simply that you've pretty much got the same thing as you started with. It's doing the same thing, and it only got to this exceptional structure by neutral, non-helpful, non-deleterious processes. So it may or may not have gone the way that Thornton's lab showed it could have gone, but it didn't help. It didn't show that Darwinian processes are building a machine or anything else.
Now, were they actually, just for my benefit, were they actually showing that a new binding site could arise, or were they saying that the original one had lost a binding site?
Yeah, they were saying the latter, that you already had all the binding sites you needed, but in one copy, a binding site was lost. And so while it could attach to one side of a protein in the ring, it couldn't attach to another. And so you needed another protein to kind of help it do so. So they're not building anything, even something as rudimentary as a protein-protein binding site. I should probably say, for the benefit of the listeners who might be wondering, you know, who cares about these binding sites, that a lot of evolutionary biologists are worried because most proteins in the cell operate not individually, not as lone rangers, but in teams, teams of six or sometimes many more. Of course, that's a problem for a gradual Darwinian point of view, because how did they all get together if they have to work in teams of six? So Thornton and a number of other folks are saying, well, maybe complexity just arises through neutral processes like we just described. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't help. You could have had the activity with just a single kind of protein, six of a single copy. But maybe through neutral processes like we just described, the complexity builds up. So this complexity that we find in life probably doesn't really have a function. It just arises just like bureaucracies tend to grow because they add, you know, a new bureaucrats who don't really do anything, make it complex. But once they're there, they're very hard to get rid of. And so that was the reason why the Thornton's group was interested in that.
Right. Okay. And also for our listeners, we've talked in the past about ATP synthase. So I just wanted to mention that this VATPase is kind of the reverse analog of that. The ATP synthase is a turbine, which is creating energy from a flow across a membrane. And the VATPase, which we're talking about today, is a pump that is pumping across the membrane to create a gradient.
Right.
So that's kind of an interesting reverse analog in that sense. So, you know, they had this proposal that, you know, seems relatively straightforward at some level. It's a common scenario that we hear proposed, that there was gene duplication, then a point mutation, a second mutation. No event is particularly deleterious. It's just neutral and kind of spreads in the population. But even with this relatively straightforward scenario, you write that their research points strongly to the limits on the sort of neutral evolution that they envision. Why do you say that?
Well, folks like Thornton are, as I said, concerned about complexity. And this ATPase that they looked at, while it has six members of a particular ring, there are other protein complexes in the cell that have hundreds of different proteins. They're concerned to be able to explain even much more complex proteins because it's very, very difficult to see how they could have arisen by Darwinian means. But in my essays responding to Thornton's work, I pointed out that it doesn't look like it's real easy to do even this neutral process because, as I mentioned, all eukaryotes, and eukaryotes are organisms with cells that have nuclei. They range from you and me down to plants and single-celled organisms like yeast. All have pretty much the same structure. And the only exception is the fungi, that is things like mushrooms and so on. And so if you expect this process to occur by chance, that is the duplication and complexification of a machine just by neutral processes, you would expect to see it pretty widely in eukaryotes. You'd expect, you know, fish to have it, or mammals and plants, and they might have different duplications, different arrangements, if this has all happened by neutral processes. But apparently it only occurred in the fungi, and it only occurred once in that kingdom. Fungi are a very, very diverse group, but nonetheless, this only occurred once. There's not a variety of these things. So it seems to me, I wrote in the essay, that this is a whole lot more unlikely to happen than the enthusiasts for this neutral complexification scenario seem to think. You know, we were talking about chloroquine resistance and Larry Moran talking about how there might be millions and millions of different ways to develop resistance to chloroquine. And you check it in nature and there's only one or a few. In the same way, these neutral schemes, well, maybe that particular thing did arise by a neutral process as Thornton's lab proposed. But if it were easily done, and if it were as probable as they were postulating, you'd expect to see it a lot more often, and right. You don't. So
well, you're a real downer, Mike. You're yeah. just
you know, let the data
get in the way here.
Yeah. Oh well, somebody's got to do it, you know.
So hey, in our last few minutes, I want to read a passage from one of your wonderful essays in the book called "The View from 30,000 Feet." So here's what you wrote: looking down from an airplane at 30,000 feet, the landscape can appear pretty smooth. It can be hard to imagine yourself in the place of pioneers in covered wagons of earlier times who had to slog over the uncleared ground bump by bump, facing rivers, ridges, and ravines. A lot of thinking about evolution over the years has been like looking down from a plane, imagining that an evolutionary trek from one large feature to another wouldn't be too difficult, that it could even be made while blindfolded and drunk. But in reality, life is lived on the ground, and without vision and sober planning, ditches, cliffs, and streams can be impassable. So the devil is really in the details, I would say, and the actual barriers are on the ground. And after this wonderful quote, you discuss three independent barriers to any undirected evolutionary mechanism. Tell us about these.
Yeah, sure. It turns out that the parts of Darwin's mechanism itself actually work to slow things down. For example, random mutation, that's necessary for a Darwinian mechanism, but it also breaks genes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes breaking genes helps to adapt to a particular circumstance. So natural selection, which would select those broken genes, kind of freezes that problem into place. And what's more, natural selection fits an organism or a biological feature to its current task, and therefore kind of makes it unavailable for doing future tasks. And finally, irreducible complexity is a big problem for Darwinian evolution, because in irreducible complexity, you need cooperation. You need several parts to do some task. But with Darwin's mechanism, you can only do one step at a time. You can't get all of the parts at once. So it's very, very difficult to produce something irreducibly complex. And as we know, irreducibly complex machinery really fills the cell.
So it's really self-limiting the evolutionary process to the extent that it's doing anything. It kind of limits itself.
Exactly. It can do a few things, but it quickly bogs down. Once you make a choice, you have committed yourself to a certain pathway, and a random, unintelligent process can't get you out of that.
Well, Mike, that's about all the time we have for today. I figure we could probably keep talking about this book for another dozen episodes, but we want to be sensitive to your time. And I know you have other projects going on as well. So thank you so much for taking the time the past couple of months to help us understand so much more about these important topics. Any final thoughts for our listeners?
Yeah, I just want to emphasize, people sometimes argue, you know, I'm for evolution or I'm for Darwin or I'm against it. But if you look at the data, it's important to realize that Darwin's mechanism does do some things. It does do some things that are medically important, like sickle cell anemia, and economically important, and so on. But it's only doing that by kind of nibbling around the edges of the complexity that is there in the cell. And while it can break things, Darwin's mechanism, and breaking the things which have important biological effects, it doesn't build things. And building things, as we know, requires foresight and it requires intelligence and it requires design.
Well said. Well, thank you, Mike, again for being with us and for putting together this wonderful new book.
Sure. Thanks for hosting me.
For our listeners, I just want to emphasize that even though we've spent several hours together over our 8 conversations, we've only covered part of what is in this detailed new book. I would encourage listeners to go out and pick up a copy of the book, catch any episodes you may have missed, and you can get a copy of A Mousetrap for Darwin in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. This is a great way to support incredibly valuable books like these. And I'm confident this book will also be a tremendous resource for you or a valuable gift for someone in your life who may have questions about evolution and intelligent design. Thank you for listening to ID the Future. Until next time, I'm Eric Anderson.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.